Hey guys, so in today's episode, I got a chance to sit down with my buddy Jesse Ray Wilkins, and this dude's pretty much one of the most phenomenal dudes I've met. He's from the great state of Kentucky, and from there he moved to San Diego and then up into Santa Cruz. One thing I really admired about him is his pursuit of knowledge and his pursuit of just a Zen mind state. He wasn't exactly sure how he wanted to open this, so what he really felt the most comfortable with was if we could have gone to a tea house, which we did, called the Imperial Tea Court in Berkeley, California. And we just sat down, started drinking some tea, and he opened up by reading a sutra. A sutra, for those of you who don't know, is an aphorism or a collection of aphorisms in the form of a manual or, more broadly, a text in Hinduism or Buddhism. Literally, it means a thread or line that holds things together and is derived from the verbal root siv, meaning to sew. And without further ado, please enjoy the sultry sounds of Jesse's voice.
All right. Moreover, Shariputra, I too will now make use of similes and parables to further clarify this doctrine. For through similes and parables, those who are wise can obtain understanding. Shariputra, suppose that in a certain town in a certain country there was a very rich man. He was far along in years, and his wealth was beyond measure. He had many fields, houses, and men servants. His own house was big and rambling, but it had only one gate. A great many people, 100, 200, perhaps as many as 500, lived in this house. The halls and rooms are old and decaying, the walls crumbling. The pillars rotten at their base, and the beams and rafters crooked and aslant. And at the tire, a fire suddenly broke out on all sides, spreading through the rooms of the house. The sons of the rich man, 10, 20, perhaps 30, were inside the house. And he thought to himself, I can escape to safety through the flaming gate, but my sons are inside the burning house, enjoying themselves and playing games unaware, unknowing, without alarm or fear. The fire is closing in on them, suffering and pain threaten them, yet their minds have no sense of loathing or peril, and they do not think of trying to escape. Shariputra, this man thought to himself, I have strengthened my body and arms. I can wrap them in a robe and place them on a bench and carry them out the house. And then again he thought, this house has only one gate, and moreover it is very narrow and small. My sons are very young, they have no understanding. And they love their games, being so engrossed in them that they're likely to be burned in the fire. I must explain to them why I'm fearful and alarmed. The house is already in flames and must get them out quickly and not let them be burned up in the fire. Having thought in this way, he followed his plan and called all his sons, saying, you must come out at once. But though the father was moved by pity and gave good words of instruction, the sons were absorbed in their games and unwilling to heed him. They had no alarm, no fright, and in the end, no mind to leave the house. Moreover, they did not understand what the fire was, what the house was, what danger was. They merely raced about this way and that in play and looked at their father without heeding him. At that time, the rich man had this thought, the house is already in flames from this huge fire. If I and my sons do not get out at once, we are certain to be burned. I must now invent some expedient means that will make it possible for the children to escape harm. The father understood his sons and knew what various toys and curious objects each child customarily liked and what would delight them. And so he said to them, the kind of playthings you like are rare and hard to find. If you do not take them when you can, you will surely regret it later. For example, things like these goat carts, deer carts, and ox carts. They're outside the gate now where you can play with them. So you must come out of this burning house at once. Then whatever ones you want, I will give them all to you. At that time, when the sons heard their father telling them about these rare playthings, because such things were just what they had wanted, each felt emboldened in heart and pushing and shoving one another, they all came wildly dashing out of the burning house. At this time, the rich man, seeing that his sons had gotten out safely and all were seated on the open ground at the crossroads and were no longer in danger, was greatly relieved and his mind danced for joy. At that time, each of the sons said to his father, the playthings you promised us earlier, the goat carts, the deer carts, and the ox carts, Please give them to us now. Shiraputra, at that time the rich man gave to each of his sons a large carriage of uniform size and quality. The carriages were tall and spacious and adorned with numerous jewels. A railing ran all around them, and bells hung from all four sides. A canopy was stretched over the top, which was also decorated with an assortment of precious jewels. Ropes of jewels twined around, a fringe of flowers hung down, and layers of cushions were spread inside, on which were placed vermilion pillows. Each carriage was drawn by a white ox, pure and clean in hide, handsome in form, and of great strength, capable of pulling the carriage smoothly, properly, at a pace as fast as the wind. Thank you. In addition, there were many grooms and servants on guard in the carriage. Each carriage was drawn by a white ox, pure and clean in hide, handsome in form, and of great strength, capable of pulling the carriage smoothly and properly at a pace fast as the wind. In addition, there were many grooms and servants to attend and guard the carriage. What was the reason for this? This rich man's wealth was limitless, and he had many kinds of storehouses that were all filled and overflowing. And he thought to himself, there's no end to my possessions. It would not be right if I were to give my sons small carriages of inferior make. These little boys are all my sons, and I love them without partiality. I have countless numbers of large carriages adorned with seven kinds of gems. I should be fair-minded and give one to each of my sons. I should not show any discrimination. Why? Because even if I distributed these possessions of mine to every person in the whole country, I would still not exhaust them. Much less could I do so by giving them to my sons. At that time, each of the sons mounted his large carriage, gaining something he had never had before. Something he had originally never expected. Shiraputra, what do you think of this? When this rich man impartially handed out to his sons these big carriages adorned with rare jewels, was he guilty of falsehood or not? What do you think of that story, Nick?
I'm going to be honest, there was a part I got distracted when everything was coming into the table.
Okay.
I was following up until the part where the son said, all these things you have promised us, you should give them to us.
Mm-hmm.
And then, from my understanding, it was just a description of the gifts that he was giving out.
Well, so at that part, you know, they're promised the goat pulled carriage, the deer pulled carriage, and the ox pulled carriage. Then they get out and they're like, yo, where's my fucking carriage, Pops? And at that point, the rich king goes, here's this really nice, well decorated, fancy thing with seven jewels. It's beautiful and amazing, isn't it? And they go, yeah. And all three sons got the same carriage.
Got one carriage to share amongst them.
They each got their own carriage, but it's all the same carriage.
And
then the rich man.
None of it was a deer carriage or an ox pole carriage.
Or a
horse pole carriage.
For that matter. It was all ultimately the same carriage. And each son got the same carriage regardless. And then the rich man goes on to say, I have limitless amounts of these carriages.
And I don't favor any of you.
Yeah, and enough for the whole country. So, I don't know your background, but more or less, there are three main vehicles in Buddhism.
Okay.
There's the Hinayana, Hinayasas. There's the middle path of the Theravadins. Oh no, they're also Hinayanas. Hinayanas, Theravadins, same thing. Those are people who only strive for their own enlightenment. There's the Mahayana, which is like you're working for everybody else's enlightenment. And then there's another path, which is, I think, the Tantra, which is more or less just trying to achieve enlightenment with the world. I could be wrong on that. But more or less, those are all what's called expedient means. Because ultimately, there's only one vehicle of Buddhism.
Mm.
And that's the you can't really call it anything. Yeah, that's the tricky thing about it, man. No arising, no sensation. That's the unborn.
Okay.
That's another way to say it.
So the carriages, the different ones, are all metaphors for the different paths of Buddhism. The one carriage at the end is the one that you speak of, which is...
So the one I speak of is more or less the ultimate attainment, but really it's no attainment. And this is, it's going to get hella paradoxical. You probably wouldn't like to do a Zen or Buddhism podcast because it's all fucking paradox. But I'll do my best to explain what I can with my limited knowledge. And please don't take this as a full or comprehensive understanding. I'm just a regular guy who likes to read books. I am not more or less of a Buddha than anybody else. So, that being said, different Zen patriarchs, they'll all say different things, and they often build off these sutras from India, because back in the ancient times, they had the natural world, and that represents symbols and things like that. Like, if you were to say an N, right, in a lot of Taoism, you want to say it. There's this passage from, I think, Lietse, who says, a man who was staying at an inn, and while there, the landlord brought him his own mat to share. The wife brought him fresh food. All the maid servants were helpful. But then he departed his inn and then came back and found he had to compete for a mat. Inns are metaphors for your body and your mind, staying within yourself. No outflows. But ultimately, they say the truest stage of, I guess, practice is... every moment is continual practice. You know, Dogen describes it as continual enlightenment, continual practice, unceasing practice.
And that's like what we were talking about earlier, just basically making everything you do throughout your day a meditation.
Yes.
So, I mean, you can meditate when you use these chopsticks to pick up this piece of lettuce. There's a more efficient way of doing it, and that would be a meditation. For instance, even just chewing your food can be a meditation. You can just be shoveling food in your mouth, being unconscious of what you're actually consuming, and then before you know it, you've put down like 3 plates of food. Or you can sit with your food, chew it, and then swallow it. And not only does that help your gut as far as digestion, but you can make that a meditation, a state of mind, peacefulness.
There are a lot of different ways to look at meditation. I don't know if you can necessarily say it's a quality of attentiveness. It's more or less... here's a really good poem that I think depicts the essence of Buddhism and Taoism and most religions, very honestly. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything, and my life flows somewhere in between.
Mm.
Now, if you read the Diamond Sutra of Buddhism, the Buddha exclaims to Shariputra, "When I attained enlightenment, I attained absolutely nothing." And often, people would be confused by this. The followers, they say, "What, you attain nothing?" But that's true in the sense that what the Buddha teaches is that this present moment is all that exists, all that has ever existed, or all that will ever exist. But it's our minds, the way our minds are ignorant, based in delusion, in one form or another, that creates this sense of continuum. But they say even at the stage of enlightenment, ignorance is the same thing as wisdom. Now, you can look at ignorance, and I apologize if this is all just rambling, but it is what it is. It might be incoherent, but I hope it makes sense to somebody. Hopefully you. So, ignorance can be said to be the delusion of the world. Your passions, your conditioning, your how habituated you are, how uncultured you are. Just everything that's more or less made you who you are, but without you ever... being aware of it, without you ever having it, until the ability to intelligently say, no, this is how I want to do it, this is how I want to use chopsticks, or this is how I want to eat food or drink tea, or etc., 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 etc. More or less your habits. Habits of behavior. Habits, same thing as conditioning. Please continue, join me. The reason I feel that Buddhism and Zen have a lot of practical value for modern life, especially in America, is because we're a very habit-focused culture. I mean, what business book or podcast have you ever read or heard that's not about cultivating good habits, cultivating good habits? There's a really brilliant philosopher named Eric Hoffer who actually has this really nice quote I like. He has a couple great quotes I like. The one I'll drop right now is, wise living consists not so much in having good habits as in having as few habits as possible. Mm. Because whenever you're doing something habitually, you're not fully engaged in it. Now, the essence of awareness, just in general, is being fully engaged in the presence of what you're engaged in that present situation.
Right.
Now, because we think linearly, because the way we're conditioned, because we have all this illusion from all this conditioning, you can look at that as sediment and soil, right?
Okay.
Now, let's look at the process of enlightenment, right? It can be likened into a flower. Even the Buddha, when he passed on the Dharma transmission to Shariputra, he did so by holding up a flower. Now, what's the nature of a flower? The flower is what rises up from dirt.
Grows with no sunlight. It from like a black void or abyss, metaphorically.
Well, yeah, but...
One of my goals is to...
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
So it grows...
From the dirt.
Yeah.
Essentially. Unless it's like a certain flower that grows from shit.
Shit, dirt, same thing. The manure, the mundane. The mundane elements of life. At all those moments in your life where you're like, I'm just sick of this. This is bored. I don't feel alive. I don't feel... Wow. Now, the first thing to do in breaking through those stages, as is acknowledged in Taoism and in Zen text, is trading the guest and the host. Because you can look at conditioned knowledge, worldly knowledge, temporal knowledge as the guest. And just like you're talking about your friend earlier, the guest starts to act like they're the host of the house, they're disrespecting it, and everything's out of order. That's why so many people... You know, it's interesting. A lot of people want so desperately and so badly to change their lives, to be somebody different, to be somebody better, to lose weight, to be great, all these things. Why?
From my perspective, anybody who might be wanting to better their lives or to be something that they currently are not could just stem from an insecurity of who they currently are. It could be... I don't like who I am now. If I can gain this skill or this way of interacting with other humans, I may be a more happy human myself.
Fair enough. And I think that that's a good... That's probably the perspective most people listening right now.
And whether or not it's true, but I would imagine that would be like the...
In my own life, I've felt such things and had such thoughts. That being said... Having felt such things and thought such thoughts, when I read Krishnamurti, that blew whole doors open, because then that guy actually started to get me to consider, you're only having those things like, I need to be better, I need to do this, because you want to achieve a standard, right? Now, what is a society? What is a community? It's this preconceived, these axioms people are agreeing to, you know what I mean? Like, oh, you know what? Gravity? You believe in gravity? Me too. Me too. Me too. Let's all be physicists. You know what I mean? You don't have to believe in gravity. It's happening any fucking way.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I think we can make these numbers and symbols to explain gravity. It's happening anyways. But look, guys, now we got a nice way to talk about it that doesn't need words.
What if there was a group of people who got together and no one believed in gravity and their conviction was so strong that they floated away?
I don't think that would happen. Gravity is the most fundamental thing to human life.
Sure.
I mean, it's very true. It's the most fundamental and all-pervasive principle in the universe.
I mean, it's more real than time. Time is a human construct.
Very much so. But that the time not existing does not negate the seasons.
True.
But the problem is you get... The problem is one of association. That's how most conditioning works, you know, stimulus response, stimulus response. oh, the clock's this time on the wall, I'm late for work. And then you get anxiety looking at clocks even when you're off.
Right.
And you don't even realize it. It's so subtle, you don't even realize it. Because that's one thing you can say about habits is they're gross, because you're not realizing it. If it was something subtle and fine, new and authentic, you'd notice it because you'd be paying careful attention. So, the first step towards the path, they say, is the flower needs to grow. Now, you can look at this as the maturing process in a person, right? You have all this sediment and dirt. The flower has to start to sprout. Now, depending on how much sediment and dirt is there, will be a huge factor in how easily the flower sprouts. Like, you know the parable of Jesus of casting seeds. If you cast on rocky soil, not much will take, etc., etc. Now, you can say that the seed of Buddhahood is intrinsic and inherent within everyone.
Okay.
However, depending on how much sediment is there, nothing's going to grow.
Would the sediment be like life challenges and adversaries that
we have? The sediment's the force of habit.
Oh, okay. Force of habit.
For example, let's say you were taught to think a certain way, right? And this is one of the big things Kevin's posted about on his Facebook about, like, specialization. It's how it can hinder you from thinking more broadly because you're so narrow-minded. Just like a horse with blinders. You've got these blinders on. You're so used to seeing this, you can't see everything else. Or like earlier, where you're walking your dog, you say you start off with a short leash, even when you have more leeway, that invisibly short leash is still there.
Right.
And knowledge acts like a blinder in this regard. So any knowledge that is not acquired, not earned, or not discovered, acts as a conditioning influence. If you're not authentically out using what you're learning, or questioning the validity of what you're learning, or challenging what you're learning. Not in the sense that you're necessarily trying to be like, gravity, that shit doesn't exist, look. You know, that line of questioning won't get you very far. You know what I mean? You're trying to come out of the dirt, not go back down into it. So don't go jumping off buildings, kids. But no, honestly, actually looking at why do I believe what I believe? How do I believe what I believe? And it can be very tricky to do that. For me to just say, why do I believe what I believe? Why do you believe what you believe? You have to look at it in relationship, because anything you ever believe is in relation to something. Like this morning on the bus ride out here to Oakland, I was cussing and some guy's like, you shouldn't be cussing. Stop cussing. I'm like, fuck you. You know? And he's like, this is a public place. He's an old Chinese man, right? Old people are always the most stiff. He's like, this is a public place. You can cuss at home, but you can't cuss in public. And I'm just thinking, what if you aren't being the same person in private as you are in public, then isn't that schizophrenic?
Yeah, it's definitely some kind of dualistic personality. At least dual. If not, like, more than that. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, to say you're doing one thing, but while doing something that's completely different, that's schizophrenia, right? You know what I mean? Like, that's I don't know. If I were trying to drink tea with one hand while pulling my other hand down with the other one, it's just very contrary behavior. And actually, you know what? I want to never mind that last 2 minutes. That wasn't cohesive. Fuck it, man. I'm sorry.
Don't even worry about it.
Yeah, man. Like, very much so. There's something to be said about being unified. So you can look at that acquired knowledge as the sediment. That's conditioned knowledge. Now, real knowledge is your intrinsic knowledge. That's your jewel of wisdom you're born with, right? In Buddhism and Zen, they say everybody has the same amount of wisdom. A fool is just the same as a wise man. Why is a fool a fool? Well, because they're more conditioned, right? Think of it like an underprivileged kid never exposed to people who challenge him to think for himself, or he's always discouraged from asking questions. That jewel gets buried deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, so it gets harder and harder for it to rise to the surface. However, that jewel is always there, always present in everyone, brilliantly shining. Everyone has the seed of enlightenment within them. That being said, why it's advocated to find a good teacher or study Zen and Buddhism is because you get these different Zen masters saying different things, and you'll get contradicting knowledge. Now, as I said, I'm no expert in, by any means, man. I'm a pretty fucked up individual, I think. But I have learned a lot in my life and accomplished much as far as teaching myself things. And I've always done that by reading one thing, and then I'll get that, oh, yeah, this way, this way, this way. But then I read something completely different, but that also makes an equally valid point. I'm like, this seems really true, too. This also seems really true. Ah!
What to believe.
Yeah, what to believe.
So, on that note, I just want to say, one reason I really enjoy talking to you every time we get the chance is because, so there was a period of time where I lived in a room by myself, and I rented this room out in a house of a bunch of strangers, and no one talked to each other, so all I did was kind of study. And that's kind of when I started getting into the Buddhism practice, and you're really the only person who I can, like, have, and I haven't been practicing, and you are constantly practicing and acquiring, like, knowledge in this field, which is why I enjoy talking to you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to mention that.
That's worth mentioning, man. Yeah, if I can be helpful, then I'm happy too, man. I've done a lot of reading on it and studied other things. But, like, more or less what I was saying, like, yeah, you get two conflicting things of knowledge. And that conflict, those dual opposites, this is just as right as this, or I thought this was wrong and now this seems right, and I thought this was right and now this seems wrong. Finding that middle ground and that balance is what's called Dhyana meditation. It's interpenetration of opposites. And it's a very curious thing that's been talked about by a lot of scholars in the last half century. Coleridge, Norman O. Brown, what's his nuts? I have one of his books, The Evolution of Consciousness. I don't know. I suck right now, but Gregory Bateson, one of my, I don't really like his work so much because they're so heady. I had to read his book at least three times and think about a lot to make sense of it, but he has these things called levels of learning, right? Level zero, that's just your instincts. Those are like lower animals. Level one is base conditioned behavior, which is most people in their everyday lives. Now, level two is where you start to become creative. That's where you learn different ways of doing the same thing, different ways of holding a cup. For example, if you speak English, French, Hawaiian, and have a good Australian accent, she can probably say, I love you, in four different ways. That's flexibility. And that's actually an essence of creativity, if you really think about it. You know, anybody that's been truly creative has been able to do something completely different apart from what's always been done. I brought this example up the other day because I think it's such a perfect one. Painting, right? Okay. People painted all throughout history, but there are greats like Picasso, Da Vinci, Michelangelo. Well, he's more of a sculptor, but you get what I'm saying? Like, there'd always been painting in human history, but these people painted in a way that was completely new and different from anybody else. Therefore, it became creative. It became groundbreaking. Pole vaulting. People used to pole vault a certain way, and then I forget his name, some white guy decided, you know what, I can just go sideways and do this funny thing and I can get higher. And it totally went against the norms, and then that became the norm. You know what I mean? The unorthodoxy of today will always be the orthodoxy of tomorrow throughout human history.
So basically, like, for celebrities on that level, just to flip the script, once Paris Hilton came out with a sex tape, everyone was like, I can become famous if I come out with a sex tape.
Yeah, but people have been making porn since the 80s, man. And no, better porn.
Not so much the people in the public eye.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it was their way of doing it.
I know what you mean. It's like, it's kind of, the general public, it's not far off to think of most people as being like sheep. You know, it's like, if you look at the way government is now compared to way back, I don't think that's actually a fair thing for me to talk about because I don't know about it, but there's a lot of corruption right now in the government, and not a lot of people are doing anything about it. 100 years ago, I think if the government were trying to pull the same things they're doing now, there probably would have been a revolution of some sort.
I think there were a few revolutions. I know that we revolted against England. I know that a lot of people revolted against their government. Yeah. I think it was actually more widely accepted to revolt against your government back in the day.
But, and while this is, again, generalization, I feel like, on average, a lot of people are very docile in the world today.
I can agree with that.
And now Zen and Buddhism is honestly about being a warrior. And it's important to look at, why are people docile? Well, they're conditioned so heavily. Did you know that the public education was originally invented, I think it wasn't Serbia, it wasn't Austria, one of those countries, but it's invented as a form of public control so that the government could get in and, like, we're going to teach the kids to be loyal citizens to the monarchy?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. That's always something I've believed in. Because I feel like before public schools and like government schools, people were out there more in experiencing the world for themselves on a first-hand basis rather than learning and reading certain things from books. And the problem with that structure is, who's handing you the knowledge? And what knowledge... something Kevin, our buddy Kevin once said, and I think this is coming from his, like, samurai readings, is you can learn a lot from someone by what they say, but you can learn a lot more from someone by what they're not saying.
Yeah. I mean, that's body language. I don't think that applies so much to the point I was making, but... Oh. Honestly, again, I'm not making very good points. I never am. But, you know, just to negate everything I've said so far. But... it's interesting, like, to look at the way of the warrior, what's going on, you know, it's standing up for yourself. Now, if you look at the way people are conditioned in a society, the degree to which you're conditioned is reflective of the degree to which you're not yourself, you're not being who you are. So if you have on a large scale a large group of people who are never taught to question not even just authority, but to question themselves, their relationships, you know, how am I living in the world? Am I eating the way I like to eat? Am I walking the way I want to walk? Am I dressing in a way that reflects who I am? You're just taught to succumb to conditions and to just acquiesce with whatever you're presented, which paradoxically is ultimately where you end up in a sense, but in a way that's more suitable to you. So that's the beginning. That's the base foundation, is your condition, right? Now, I said level two in Gregory Bateson's hierarchy of learning is learning different ways of doing the same thing. That's where you start to find freedom. Let's say you're told you have to mow the lawn, right? You can't get out of it. You're fucked into mowing the lawn. But you can at least find a way to mow it in a way that's fun for you. You can mow different patterns, different styles, different pathways. And then once you find a way to creatively express yourself in that thing that was formerly an act of oppression, there starts to open up a little bit of freedom and intelligence. You're like, huh, I've done it this way. I wonder how else I can do this.
That's actually a really funny point, because I had to mow the lawn. And growing up, very exactly to the point of what you were saying, I didn't like the way I was being told to do it. And one day I was told to do it, like, left to right, let's say. And instead I went diagonal, corner to corner. And it actually ended up looking a lot better than I thought it would. And just because it was something, and probably just because it was something new, my lines might have been crooked as fuck. But I had a lot more fun doing it. And when it was done, the person telling me to mow the lawn actually had no complaints. They thought it was cool too.
Yeah.
Because, like you were saying earlier, especially with math, I can count to 10 by adding 5 and 5. You can get to 10 by adding 5 twos together. You know, there's different ways to come to the same...
2 and 8.
2 and 8.
3, 1, and 6.
There you go.
It's having a multiplicity of means is what creates flexibility in the human mind. Now, I know there's a lot of talk about neuroplasticity and everything, but the root of neuroplasticity and overcoming compulsion, and this goes for any compulsive disorder behavior that people become afflicted with, is finding different ways of doing the same thing. That's where you start to find choice. And choice is the very fundamental essence of freedom. So, you know, ultimately Zen and Buddhism are about becoming human and loving people. Now, if you're a complete slave to conditioning, if you're completely forced like an animal into a fucking routine or a pattern that you had no say or control over, and you're living that, you're not probably not going to be a very loving and kind and compassionate person. You're going to have a hard time reaching out to others and helping others. But the thing is, in human, the way humans are, let's see somebody does something great, right? Well, you're exposed to that all the time, right? Like celebrities or Paris Hilton. Paris Hilton, she's fucking making money. Oh, look, she's taking hella dick. And she's making more money. What, you know, what's that set for young girls? Because it, and I'm not trying to say what Paris Hilton did was bad or wrong. I don't think there's a right or wrong ultimately. It's ultimately the only question is what's right for you, and that's what you have to ask. But as far as the conditioning factor goes, that then that becomes the standard, you see?
Sure.
It's like if one person is distinguished or achieved, and then somebody knows, oh, look, they sit with straight posture and they never put their elbows on the table. We should make it rude and impolite to eat with your elbows on the table. When I was little, my mom used to beat me with a ruler if I put my elbows on the table. You know what? Look at me now. Look at me now. Oh.
Elbows all over, dancing all over that
table.
Yeah,
no fucks given, man. But, or even cussing on the motherfucking train. It's like, you have to do you at the end of the day, but so many people don't want to do them because they're so scared to offend other people. And that's the biggest thing that works against you. Is you, I don't want to do me because it might offend these other people, and then they'll hurt me, or they won't like me, or they're going to be angry with me.
A lot of times it's the opposite. Sometimes people see an individual being themselves and just doing whatever like feels right. I mean, to some degree, I'm not saying like murder or anything like heinous, but like, there's times where I'll just start dancing in the middle of the bowling alley just because I feel like dancing in the middle of the bowling alley. And you know me, I've told you, I've expressed, I'm not a huge dancer, but if I get the feeling, I might as well like seize that feeling at that moment.
Fun is contagious, and happiness is something meant to be shared, man. Like, you know, most people, the only people that really love sad people are miserable people. And I'm not saying that sad people or miserable people should be avoided. Like, honestly, this is another thing that comes up, too. Is like, a lot of people are like, you know what? I want to stay away from that person. They're negative or whatever, blah, blah, blah. But you only want to stay away from negative people because you're influenced by negative people.
You feel like their negativity may rub off on you.
Yeah. And this is an incorrect, limited view. Because ultimately, Buddhism and Zen or Taoism are about moving beyond the self. Now, this first stage can be likened, though not necessarily the same as level 2 learning, but level 3 learning. This is where, in doing all this tinkering around, figuring out how you feel, right? For example, a good example from my life that's helped me, and this happened on a level I can't really be sure I understood how it worked, but I was walking through the parking lot of school one day, right? When I was still, I used to get in trouble, get arrested for being a bad boy. Not too bad, you know. But, I was coming up on a cop car. I got tremendous anxiety all through my body. And I realized, it hit me. I just stopped. And I was like, you know what? Not a single fucking car in this entire parking lot do I look at and even feel two fucks about. But just the sight of this car gave me anxiety, man. Just the sight of it.
Yeah.
Just like when you see an ex and you're like, oh, I hope they don't come over and talk to me, you know? Just that sensory stimulation can wreck you. Now, that is conditioning, my friend. And one way or another, your experiences with the people in your life or with others or with objects, you're conditioned. Now, how do we undo our conditioning? We have to look at our conditioning. We have to become aware of our conditioning. And often it's through an experience like that. Now, if there had been a lot going on, children yelling, everything, I might not have been aware of that because it was completely quiet, silent, and I was able to directly feel the influence and going from a peaceful, calm mood to, oh, I'm wrecked with panic and anxiety from seeing the cop. Then I was able to realize, I have a relationship with cops. Look, and then I had to really look at myself. Well, am I a criminal? Because even when I'd have a car behind me, I'd be nervous I'd get pulled over. But you know what, dude? I haven't stolen anything in well over a decade. I'm a relatively law-abiding. I may cuss on subways and put my elbows on the table, but, you know.
Actually, this last year, 2015, they made cussing on subways and dancing elbows on tables. They made those federal crimes.
Yeah. You know what? At this point, I think they're going to put me in the pokey, man. But it's like,
you know, as long as you don't do the hokey pokey.
Oh, dude, every day of my fucking life. But, yeah, man, like, if we really look at it, you have to look at your relationships, you know what I mean? I did this Vipassana meditation one time, and around, I kept seeing this one guy, and every time I'd see him, I'd be like, yuppie faggot, yuppie faggot. Around day eight, I realized, it's like, as soon as I see this guy, that comes in my head. Mm. You know, even, I think it's the same with racists. You see a person of color, nigger, or chink, or faggot, or whatever. Whatever is horrible about that person, you just see them, and it's coming up in your head, and then you have to really stop and be like, well, hold up, man, I have a beard. I have long hair. I like to use biodegradable soap. You know, I'm the yuppie faggot, man. I'm a yuppie. I'm wearing a fucking suit, right? This jacket, right, a goddamn cardigan blazer, right? I'm the yuppie faggot.
Looking dapper as fuck, might I add.
Dude, yeah. But it's like, it's that kind of thing. Like, I would not have noticed that if not for having a sense of stillness about me at that time when I could notice myself respond and react like that. That's, I think, what the Buddhist, the Taoist, and the Zen tradition indicate when they say stillness is essential for the way. Because with a certain sense of stillness and calm and ease, then you're kind of clearing away internal chatter and you can start to notice these things. And then when you notice that, you really have to, I think, start to look at, was that how I want to feel about that person? Or is that just what I was told to feel, right? Do I want to feel hateful and spiteful to someone? I really don't know. Or just is that just what I've been told my whole life, growing up a poor guy in Kentucky, you know? Mm. And it's like, I think really, if you really look at it, like, do you want to hate anybody?
No.
I don't think anybody wants to have to hate anybody. It's actually, if you really start to get still and notice it, whenever you're getting angry, you can't get angry without feeling angry.
Right.
Yeah, it's a lot of work to be angry. It's a lot of work to be upset. And I think most people do what they do. They get in these routines to avoid their anxieties. Because you don't want to deal with anxiety. You don't want to deal with being upset.
Yeah, so you get in a routine to feel comfortable. And in that comfort comes a false sense of, I'm going to be happy. Because I'm putting myself out of the way of anger, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it could be a number of things. We shouldn't be too reductionistic or simplistic with it. It's often interesting, too, because it's like, let's say you try to get yourself in a routine. There are certain people I've known in my life, they love to make themselves angry. You can say the anger is an addiction because they want to do whatever it is to get that anger. Because it's interesting in that concept of dhyana meditation. It's the reconciliation of opposites, so, you know. Without hatred, there could not be love. Without joy, there could not be sorrow. Without happiness, you could not have sadness. So you want to do something to elicit a sense of catharsis. So I think a lot of people choose artificial stimulations like music or movies or TV to try to conjure those feelings that they aren't really experiencing in their daily life as a callus for spiritual growth. But often there's no substitute for genuine experience. I mean, why else do people go, you know, certain people are inclined to watch romance movies or listen to sad music because you want a sense of catharsis. You're trying to bring whatever it is you're trying to hide from. Unconsciously, at some level, you're trying to bring it to the surface through your regular activities and behaviors because that part of you wants to wake up and become an experience in your life.
That's funny. I actually know a few people who, as we were mentioning before, as far as routines and falling into routines, and one thing that they'll do is they outwardly try to persuade people, like, oh, I'm against drugs or I'm against violence or whatever. And then what they do is they'll, like you said, they'll go watch television or a movie, and what are they watching? They're watching Weeds, the TV show, or they're watching 24 with Jack Bauer, where it's nothing but explosions for 24 hours in one day.
You know, it's impossible to speak without being a hypocrite, man, and I'm probably fucking myself by talking right now. I mean, honestly, they say the great way is beyond words, and that's just the truth of it. So, sure. You know, you can't talk about it, and the more you talk and try to intellectualize it, the further you get. So, you know, you can read all these books by Carl Jung or other people, and yeah, they got a lot of nice things to say, but at the end of the day, it's about being who you are and moving beyond your concepts and limitations. Because a curious thing about what happens after you're interpolized, you know, if you really look at whenever people are saying I, it's almost always in the form of an opinion or a position. You know, when this dude brought out this tea, because I work at the tea house, I'm like, he's not doing it right. He's not doing it this way. That's being hella judgmental. Yeah. But I still don't, honestly, like I can say from tasting it and just the feel of the place, I'd say where I work is probably more fucking swanky and like, not swank in the sense of classy, but just like the, I guess the spirit of tea, how I would, if you're going to say tea has a spirit, spirit as a spiritual practice, I feel more spiritual practicing it at the fucking Hidden Peak, dog.
Yeah, I've been to your establishment of business, employment, and it's really amazing. The entire energy vibe there is really unlike any place I've ever been before. They actually have like a strict, I want to say rule, like no electronics. They politely ask you, but it's implied that they really don't want you to have your phones on or any electronics on it for that matter.
We would have been kicked out long ago.
Yeah, that's actually why we're recording this here at this other tea house.
And drinking this less than awesome tea. But more or less, that's like the gist of it. You know, I didn't explain it in the best way maybe, but I hope it can be helpful to people because it really is helpful, you know?
I'm going to be honest. My previous podcast I haven't listened to over again. I've had my sound guy, Brandon, you met him.
Yeah.
He's listened to them. But I myself haven't, mainly because I was there and I was talking to the people who I was talking to. However, this one I am going to go back and listen to.
The biggest thing to take away from it is Zen and Buddhism are about honestly living your life. And now I'm emphasizing the concept of being yourself and being who you are because then that's what starts to nourish the seed, right? And now you can say, okay, well, if you're really heavily set, it's hard, it's impossible. Well, you know what? Nothing's impossible. It's just maybe more difficult in the beginning. But once you get that ball going, it's a fucking... It's like you have a phoenix in your chest. Dude, the first time I read Christian Murray, I started looking at my... After I realized that cop car thing, dude, what happened was that very night, I bought 3 cookies, and I walked outside. There happened to be 2 cops. I gave 2 cops 2 cookies. And instantly, it was like this huge release happened in my entire being. I wouldn't even say just my mind or body, but my being just felt relieved. And they were happy. They were like, oh, my God. They were so surprised to see somebody be nice. And
it's so unfortunate that our cop and our like law system is based on a punitive system. Because it just gives these cops, the police officers, I should say, like a negative stigma in the eyes of everyone else. Where... A lot of them are just normal people, literally just doing a job. And for the most part, I don't think most of them are doing it for money. I think they're doing it for, like, health benefits.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're going to put their life on the line so that later, when they're older, they can actually not have to worry and stress so much about supporting themselves.
Well, I think it's perpetuated both ways. I mean, honestly, like, you know, people feel the cops are these militant assholes, so they treat them as such, and they don't treat them like members of the community.
Right.
Then the cops feel excluded, so they don't feel so much a part of the community that they're protecting and serving so much as they're policing and regulating.
And something that I've heard recently, which actually ties into everything you've been saying, and especially with officers, is that you're, like, on a
subconscious?
I'll get back to the word, but... Your expectations of someone actually plays into how that person or thing acts.
Or react or respond to you.
Yeah.
I think that can be evidenced throughout numerous examples in life, man. Like, honestly, that's the basis of conditioning. Most people think habits are simple stimulus response. No, that's wrong. There's always an element of expectation. And so most people want to change their habits because you want to change your expectations. Oh, I'm tired of expecting that I'll get kicked in the nuts every time I leave my home or every time I talk to a girl, she'll throw a drink on my face. I think that's one of the benefits of actually trying to test your thing, like reductio ad absurdum. Like, okay, I'm going to prove to myself I won't get a drink thrown in my face by talking to this girl and then go talk to her. And God forbid you get a drink thrown. Throw on the gravel. Let's bury this motherfucker deeper, you know what I mean? But Yeah, dude, it's worth looking into. So, you know, part of Zen and Buddhism, and honestly looking at how you're relating to life in the world and whether it's the way you authentically want to be expressing yourself, is the way you talk, the way you really want to be talking, is your manner of speaking, is your manner of walking, acting. How many ways can you make a cup of coffee? How many ways can you find a sit down chair come up? How many ways can you sit down on the ground in a way that's comfortable and makes you feel like who you are? And doing these things is not only about becoming more human, but it's also about becoming a responsible member of your community, man. Because if you look at the word responsibility, what's a response? A response is not a reflex, my friend. A response is a choice, something you choose to do. Mm. Ability. Ability is reflective of capacity, capability, what you're able to do or achieve. So becoming more responsible or increasing your levels of responsibility as a human being, as a member of your community, is not just about taking on more challenges, although challenge plays an element in the cultivation of skill, and that can't be argued. It is about also learning new ways to respond to challenges, new ways of doing, being, becoming creative, which is what most of the modern movements on any of these fucking podcasts or psychology is about. Untapping your creative potential to become yourself and a more full expression of yourself in a variety of situations in the world. Being creative not just when you're painting, not just when you're writing, but when you're speaking, when you're moving, when you're dancing. You know, truly creative people are creative in every endeavor of life, but it's through the practice of becoming mindful of how we're expressing ourselves in these different contexts that we begin to unleash and tap into that creativity. And that releasing creativity can only come through a process of penetrating our relationships to our movement, to our speaking, to our thinking, to our ways of viewing the world and who we're talking to, how we're having conversations. And in that comes great freedom and then great choice. And then because you have choice, you have freedom. Freedom's not something you're given by the government. It's not something you're given by your family. It's something that you have a choice in. And that's why I think Freud, I'm probably fucking up his quote, but he's a fucked up person, you could say. Different people have different things. I've never read the man, so I won't judge him too much. But one thing I read I loved was that most people are incapable of true freedom because true freedom requires great responsibility.
Yeah. That's a great quote.
But that's only the first step, man, because you can say, okay, I have all these choices. I'm becoming more alive in the world. You know, I'm starting to realize I can speak to people in a way that I didn't think I could. You know, I can put my elbows on the table because I'm an adult now, and I can if I want. But it's a choice. I don't have to. A lot of people might get caught up in thinking, okay, now that I can do this, I have to do it. Well, that's a compulsion. That's not freedom. If you can do it because you authentically want to do it, that's wonderful. But spontaneity is the key element. Now, in Buddhism, they say there's your inner essence, right? Your life essence, your vital source. The same life that is vital within you is vital within me, is vital with that person down there, is in the trees and whatever. But that's all conceptualization. But life is life, and it's vitally beating. And they say that your heartbeat is the pulsing of that life force, and that your journey in life is really not a journey to greatness, not to fame, to success and glory, not to becoming made a legend in some great grand story or scheme of the cosmos, so much that the people of the states would make a constellation in your honor. But the journey of life is a journey of the heart, and it's always back into yourself because you acquire these sediments. And now, along the line, as the flower starts to bloom and blossom, you can say, oh, fuck this dirt, but you know what I mean? Does a flower really ever begrudge the soil from which it came? Because if not for that soil, if not for that conditioning, you never have that flower.
Never would have even sprouted from the seed.
Yeah. So along the beginning stages, when you start to become differentiated, when you start to become an individual, then even myself, I still do this slightly with the education system, you can start to hate the system because you're like, you know what? I'm so much better. In spite of that system, fuck that system, it's running people, let's destroy that system. Then you become antagonistic to the system. Yet without that system, you never would have had anything to rebel against, and that you never could have become an individual. So there are no rebels without conformists, and vice versa. And they need each other. And this is part of the complementary of life. So initially there's some initial heading, but that's like a flower trying to dig back into the dirt, you know? Instead, you want to bring up more and bring out a whole bush, start to unfold your petals. Now, what's the unfolding of petals? Well, that's the rain. That's the rain of truth. That's the rain of confidence. You start to find all this freedom. And you know what, man? Life's not the way I have always been told it is. It's not these set of rules. I don't have to get married. I don't have to become old and lonely. I don't have to do all these things. I can start to be who I am and who I want to be. And then you start to find yourself drawn to things, circumstances, events, and individuals. I'll tell you a scene from my life. I've always had mixed... My sexual life has just been fucked. Like, not in the way...
That you would want it to be.
Yeah. Dude, I've fucking gone on Craigslist. I've experimented with my sexuality. I've been to many whorehouses in my life. None inside the States. I was in the Navy. I fucking experiment with dudes from being sexually frustrated. I've had, in high school, I had this deaf girl give me a blowjob, and the next day she wanted to date me. I said no. She slapped me because I didn't want to learn sign language. She told the whole school I had a small penis in sign language. Juicy small.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a bitch.
It fucked me, bro. And then I had another girl, like, mid-blowjob. She's like, and it was kind of fucked how we met, but, like, we've been... Fuss and fight. All we do was fucking fight. And then she's like, you know, yucca, yucca, yucca. You got a mediocre penis, yucca, yucca. I went flaccid, bro. I was like, what the fuck you mean I got a mediocre penis, you bitch?
Wow.
Dude, I was going crazy, right?
Some bitches are brutal.
Yeah, but I mean...
For no reason.
And I only say it in a past tense. You know, I've gotten over it to a large degree. I've actually had some good sexual relationships. But as far as actual loving relationships, partnerships, intimate relationships... I can't say I've ever explored that much. And a perspective of mine used to be held that women were cowardly. But honestly, I just feel like every time I try to be honest and straightforward with a woman, they'd be very shy. And not that I'm an aggressive guy. I'm willing to say I'm a very sexual guy. But just like, I would feel like women weren't straightforward. So I was writing one night. I'm writing in my notebook about this. Because like, you know, sometimes you got to dwell on the issue. You're going to have like anxiety, right? Why am I angry? It's not always like, oh, that's why I'm angry. You can have all these things, right? All these things, but you have to keep whittling. It's like whittling. It's like, to go back to the whittling, right? If I had been having cop cars and ambulances and scary clowns and my mother all in that parking lot at the same time, I would have had four different things to give me anxiety. So I couldn't have figured out what's giving me anxiety. But because there was only the cop car, I was able to isolate it. So that's the process, and that's the value of studying logic and science. You know, Eli Zinn says it's no thought, and most people can think that you just want to give up thinking completely. No.
Is that the same as the idea of no mind, where you're just being?
It is, but... The thing is, you sharpen your intellect so much so that there's nothing left. It's like whittling the blade continually. So you have all these factors, right, that could be making you angry or upset. You have to continually sharpen, 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 hone the blade of reason, of intuition. Those are your two blades, your blade of reason, of wisdom, and of intuition. Although, truthfully, wisdom and intuition become the same thing. It all becomes the same thing in the great void. But those are the three bodies. You have your internal essence of life. You have wisdom, and you have your actions and motions. Now, a lot of people get lost in thought, philosophers, blah, 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 but their thoughts are not practical. They're not action-oriented. Anything you'll ever do in your life, from brushing your teeth, washing your hair, touching, hugging, making love, fucking, kissing, drinking, eating, pissing, shitting, is a physical act. So the more fully aware and completely impregnated you can become within that act. And when I say impregnated, fully immersing your awareness. Like, when you're shitting, how are you shitting? What's going on in your stomach and your anus and your hips and your thighs and your knees? Can you shit with your whole being?
Have you heard of this new way of shitting that they've been doing studies on, where you put your feet up on the toilet seat and, like, crouch on the seat?
Oh.
Apparently,
I
like,
feel like it's an Asian that came up with it.
Wait.
Trapped in America. Trapped in America. Wanna go to Asia. Cause I love T.E.
Are you gonna make a trip out to Asia?
Me. I'd love to. That'd be really cool.
Hey, if you go out to some Asian country, you let me know.
Yes, sir.
I am a little. I hate to be envious, but sometimes it happens. And our buddies Kevin and Emma, I wish them so much luck and so many wonderful experiences while they endeavor in Thailand. That's gonna be really rad. And I look forward to meeting up with them in years to come.
You know, technically, if we're being really Zen and Buddhist, we can say that there are no Kevin and Emma, there's no Thailand, and there will never going to be a Kevin or Emma or a Thailand, and we'll never go anywhere. Because technically, right here is all we have. This fountain, this table, this tea, you and me.
You are correct.
But see, here's the thing, right? And it's such an innocuous thing. Your mind, because your mind is not limited. It's unbounded. Now, a lot of people think it's of killing the mind. No, it's unobstructing the mind so it can flow freely and go freely. But look, when you have anxiety, you might want to talk to the girl, but you won't even think about it because there is an anxiety there. Or your body is still. You won't move because you're scared. Now, I'm not saying to move anyway despite being scared, but to fully be scared, to analyze that fear, to really get down to the heart of that fear. And so back to the story with the girl, I'd whittle it down to, I feel women are cowardly. And that was the only grudge I had against women. At that exact time, the girl who I'd last hooked up with, who had just recently jaded me and left, and brought this to the fore, brought this deep emotional anxiety, whatever, to the fore, so much I was writing about it, I heard my phone text, and I just knew. I knew it was her. And I look at my phone, it was her. She's like, hey, I have something I want to say to you. I wrote you a letter. I can call you if you want. I call her up. Dude, we had a heart-to-heart. And it's just like giving the cops the cookies, right? I became aware of that anxiety. And then talking to her about it, I faced it and I dealt with it courageously. And, dude, it was gone. It was gone, man. And it felt so good. And that's life, dude. And it's like they say there's this thing called missing the boat, right? Now, if you become like some philosophers or some people, you spend your whole life in the books, well, everything you've ever done, you're just Gumby. You're just a fairy tale, a fiction, a Don Juan, a Casanova. You're lost in Shakespeare. But you're never you, man. You're not living your life. Now, you can only be a baby once, right? And now a lot of people might go to therapy and learn life.
Depends on how you live your life. I know a lot of baby adults.
Yeah. but that's just immaturity, right? It's just like a lack of responsibility, a lack of development. And at certain points, just like they've shown, if you don't, if kids aren't exposed to language at a certain age, they'll never develop it. Now, from a standpoint, you can say that you're here in this life with a destiny, right? To live it. To live it as you, who you are, and then by being who you are and fully living who you are, you're going to naturally come into that heart source. Because how do you judge, just like I was able to know somehow when that text went off, it was her. As you start to go through these things, when that comes up and these things happen, just out of the blue, just these unrealistic coincidences, Jung called them synchronicity. You start to trust, like, something is up. Like, at the exact same time this happened to me, this happened here. And that's where you start to move beyond that boundary.
Can we take a...
That's fine. Let's go get gelato. You start to move beyond that boundary of you and me, of I and the universe. And you really start to see it's like the same thing, the same heart that beats in mine is the heart that's beating in eternity. It's the lifeblood of creation. And it's... it's trying to flow through you. But then there's also the real weird, paradoxical, fucked up thing is like the same factors that condition you, your community, your society, the system, is in every much way that same part of that same cycle in life, but in universe. And so that's what's really kind of fucked about the whole damn Big Bang shebang. And honestly, I can't claim to know anything. I haven't ever had any like crazy... visual like experiences or these otherworldly, like I'm one with God. I've never had any of that. I wouldn't say I'm enlightened, but as much as I can tell, that's the nature of paradox, you know? It's like, damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? We're all going to die any fucking way. That's why the biggest things I'd like to impart to people listening or to you, that they say to help you in this process, if you look at what conditions a person, fear, pain. Now, there's this meditation of equanimity. Now, what is equanimity? Equanimity is responding to everything equally. You know, if I hear this sound of this fountain, feel this breeze against my hand and my face and my hair, and I'm also looking at you, I'm not doing all of those things separately, but if you listen to my language when you go back and listen to this, you're going to hear it in an order, but really it's happening all simultaneously. And that's what language can never convey, and that's why they always say the way is beyond words, because everything is right here. Like, if you have to think of the future and talk about your plans or your goals, you have to leave right here. You have to leave what you're currently engaged in, the act of sitting. Are you sitting how you want to sit? Are you expressing yourself in sitting? Is listening to me an authentic act?
At this moment, it is. For the people not here with us at this moment, in experiencing this tea house and experiencing the elements on our skin, no.
But maybe it might touch them. And it hopefully might touch it them. Will. You know?
One quick thing that you brought up that I kind of was thinking about was... I don't remember exactly what you said.
Impermanence.
It wasn't that. Maybe you'll remember what it is that you said. But what I was thinking of as a meditation is... One thing I told you, I try to meditate throughout my day. And one thing I've been trying to do is... I've heard that every human is a different version of yourself. So when you and I have a conversation, or when I have a conversation literally with anyone, I look at that person and I try to find myself in that person, and I try to really listen to what I'm telling myself through that other person to myself as this person. How does that fit in with, like, Buddhism? Or does it?
Well... So there are four cognitions, right? Going back to the three bodies, there's the inner essence, which is, I guess, the Tao, the beginningless end, and the final beginning, Zen. There's the next layer, which is your intuition, your wisdom. This is said to be the deepest level of who you are as an identity. It's that which has carried you through all these aeons and kalpas and reincarnations. It's that which you is transmigrated and reborn. Then there's the essential body, which is your body that brushes your teeth, washes your hair, brushes your hair. So three levels of consciousness, three layers of mind, but in reality they're all the same mind. And you have these four inherent seeds, and these are the four elements of wisdom, four cognitions. And since they're inherent in you, the Buddhists and Zen people say it's useless to seek it outside. You can't go to me or anybody else to teach you these, how to cultivate these things. Although people who are more cultivated, much like a gardener, knowing that they're inherent, everybody can help bring them out. I think that's why people go as Zen masters, because it's like, look, I can tell you're further along than me. Can you teach me something? And yeah. But really, the Zen master, all they're doing is helping to bring out that person's own nature. So those four cognitions are what? They're likened to petals of a flower or directions of the thing. So the east one is one we've already addressed. That's where you start to question everything you've been given. You start to come out of the soil. The south gate is the practice of equanimity. You're becoming indifferent to pleasure or pain, which does a lot to free you. And you have less desires because you're no longer doing things so much for pleasure or for fear of pain. So you're getting rid of a lot of fear and anxiety that way. You're becoming indifferent to, you know, you're not starting to not think that what you're hearing is different than what you're seeing, what you're feeling. You're realizing it's all simultaneously. So you're engaged in the constant practice of simultaneously experiencing experience. How's that for a tongue twister? That's the south gate. The west gate is the study of Zen scripture, Zen literature, different books, both secular and non-secular, on just a wide variety of knowledge. And this is done for the purpose of, just like I'm talking to you, you remember I start off with the story of the king. He's got the kids, and then there's the passage where he says, the king knew his kids well. He knew their interests, and thus was able to devise some expedient means to lure them out of the house, such as, if you go outside, you'll have a deer cart. If you come outside, I have an ox cart. If you come outside, I have this nice goat cart. But then when they all really got outside, it was the same vehicle. It was a white ox cart. This is the purpose of that practice of study, to learn, not just through book learning, but interacting with people, the hearts of men, the minds of men. And thus Zen masters help people through recognizing what's going to help this person grow and become the bright flower they are. Now, the northern quadrant is your intuition. Now, like I said, when you penetrate the interpolarities, you can see two opposites as the same thing. Love, the same thing as hate. You know, joy and sorrow, both the same. You start to come to that fundamental nature, but then since you're not leaning against anything, you're less ego-based and you're more universal. So in a paradoxical way, the more individualized you become, the more universal you become. But paradox is the name of the game in Zen and Buddhism. It just is. Defies logic. Just like I could say, you're hearing a stream, you're feeling a breeze, and sitting in a chair listening to my melodic voice. But you're doing all those things simultaneously, and language can never do you justice. Language can never truly speak the heart. And a wise friend of mine once said that words are honest lies at best. And that doesn't mean that one should lie, because in learning to be honest, just like when you lie and you feel guilty, or you do something wrong, you feel guilty. You think you're going against your beliefs, and in time, as you explore your relationships, you get clear on, like, is this how I want to feel? Is not so much in regards to how you want to feel in general, but like in relation to what you're doing, like, is that what I'd want to do? I mean, what was Pythagoras' golden rule? Let no day pass that you don't go back and say, was I me that day? In what situation could I have been myself more, you know? Would I have really liked to have pulled my car over and said hi to the girl on the side of the street? I've had that. I find oftentimes when I ruminate, it's because I don't follow my heart, because I'm scared or whatever. So the practice of equanimity, moving beyond pleasure and pain, not only does it have a dual sort of helping you begin to cut away passions and desires that keep you from being present, it also does a lot to remove anxiety and fear that keeps you from being who you are and not missing your chances. You know, in the tea service, in the tea game, there's a saying at every tea ceremony, just this moment, one opportunity once in a lifetime. You might never see that girl again. We might never be here having a podcast again. We might never be talking again. So it's very important to learn to follow your heart and express it when you need to. So these practices of equanimity, of starting to look at your relationships and see if you're being true to yourself and who you are, these practices of following your intuition in your heart, these practices of talking to people and getting a sense of the wide variety of ways people can be in the world, you start to get a sense of, I can be anyway, because I don't have to be like these people I grew up with. Look how these people here live, how this person's living. And then the last meditation, that's the most beneficial and the core essence of all Buddhism, it said you're not a Buddhist because you say you're a Buddhist. You're a Buddhist because you practice impermanence. What's impermanence? All things are fading, just this moment, one opportunity in a lifetime. We're all going to die any day. So many people live their lives making these 10-year plans, 20-year plans. And that's how so many businessmen do. That's the capitalist mindset. I'll live forever. Let me get rich. Or, you know, I'll spend time with my family when I've got this goal done. I'll go on this vacation. I've got the opportunity now. But you know what? I'm working towards this goal that will be accomplished within 6 months. So you miss all these opportunities to live your life and be fully yourself and to flower because of these goals, these desires. And so always getting that mindset, you know what? I'm going to die. I'm a walking pile of bones. The only difference between me and the corpse in the ground is I still have flesh on me.
In all honesty, we're dead already.
Very much so. We're dead already, but that doesn't mean we should negate the life we live and become nihilists.
Right.
It's a call to live more fully because we are going to die.
Correct. Yeah, man. Well, we should probably wrap up. I think they're trying to kick us out of here.
Yeah, I'll have to get some gelato.
Yeah, it's been real fun having you talk. And
I feel like I hogged the mic there.
No, that's fine. No, that's exactly how I like to run these things. I know that you aren't ever going to listen to this one or any of the other ones I put out. and I'm okay with that, but this is how I run them. I basically just, I get one of my buddies to talk, and in lulls, I get them to talk about something else. That's how I run it. So, again, like, as always, it's just super fun hanging out with you. I really wish and look forward to the day that we just get to just kick it on a more frequent basis.
Can we be, like, semi-professional? Nice talking, partner.
Nice talking, buddy. Yeah. There's a handshake going on. For sure, man. Well, to all the listeners, we're going to go get some gelato. Peace.
Thanks for joining me once again. And I just want to let everyone know that you can find me on facebook.com/positiveherpes, Instagram and Twitter. My handle is @positiveherpes. And go ahead and write to me any questions or comments or even suggestions at positiveherpes@gmail.com. And one last shout out to Jesse Ray Wilkins for choosing the track that has been playing. This is Always See You Wide Awake off of Lucas Ohio's album, The Slingshot Kid. You can find Lucas Ohio on his website, lucasohio.com, and his next show will be at Armando's in Martinez, June 20th. It's short 18 days away.
Close and think of you often.